Welcome to the Femme Health Podcast, where we focus on providing clarity and evidence-based facts in female health and wellness. The internet, or as us physicians like to say, Dr. Google, can be overwhelming for patients seeking reliable information. And unfortunately, not all of that information is backed by research, science, and real doctors. Here, we pride ourselves on demystifying medicine for you and giving you access to some of the most talented medical doctors or experts in their field. I'm your host, Dr. Sayan Akbori, and I interview doctors so you can have an inside look at what I would ask my colleagues if I had a medical question. Let's get started with today's episode. Hi, everyone. So today we are going to talk about a super hot topic in women's health, egg freezing or oocyte cryopreservation. Oocyte means egg and cryo means to freeze, and I think we all know what preservation means. So this is a really great opportunity for anyone who is thinking about egg freezing to learn from a real doctor who is an expert in it. I want to welcome our expert physician, Dr. Rashmi Kudasia, to the Femme Health Podcast. Dr. Kudasia is a board-certified REI specialist currently based out of Houston, Texas. She is board certified in reproductive endocrinology and infertility. Now, to give you an idea of how long it takes to become an REI specialist, I will lay it out for you. So that's 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 4 years of OBGYN training, and then 3 more years of reproductive endocrinology and infertility training. So that's 15 long years post-high school before you can call yourself that. She is the Sugar Land Site Director and Director of Patient Education at the CCRM Fertility in Houston. She is also Assistant Clinical Professor of OBGYN at Houston Methodist Hospital. She has received multiple awards and grants for her clinical care and research and has presented and published her work all over the U.S., as well as abroad. She is also the American Society for Reproductive Medicine's Young Physician Delegate to the American Medical Association. So truly an expert in her field. So welcome, Rashmi, and thank you for taking the time out to chat with us.
My pleasure. This is really an exciting opportunity. So thank you so much, Saya, for having me.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, one of the reasons I really wanted to talk about this is because I froze my own eggs 2 years ago. And I felt that I really didn't have a clear idea of the process until I was actually almost done with the cycle. And I'm a doctor. And so even as a doctor who knows the right questions to ask and where to go online to look up the information, I didn't feel clear on the process. And do you think that there is some confusion about the process of egg freezing? And if so, why?
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start. I think there's definitely confusion, and there's a lot of reasons for that. I think for all women, you know, one of the big things that I'm really passionate about is improving education and reproductive health literacy in the first place. I mean, honestly, in the consultations that I do, it's not uncommon that as I'm going through just the basic concepts of why the menstrual cycle happens the way that it does and, you know, fertility and how to get pregnant, people stop me at the end of that. And they were like, oh my gosh, if somebody had just explained all of this to me when I first thought about getting pregnant or first thought about egg freezing, that would have been so helpful. And so it's really sad that, you know, we don't have universal access to comprehensive sexual education in this country. And so many of us are just kind of going through and having periods and maybe being on birth control and not really understanding, you know, what's meant to happen with their reproductive system. So I think that's definitely part of it. You know, we'll talk about some of the nitty gritty, but I think that, you know, kind of understanding how the eggs develop and sort of the timeline of things is super confusing. And a lot of people think that it's a process that's going to take months and months. And so I think, you know, it's just really getting at some of those basic points of how our reproductive physiology works as women and kind of trying to address that early in life. And then thinking about egg freezing specifically, you know, having a better understanding of the timeline of things and why it works the way it does, basically.
And I couldn't agree with you more on that, because I was definitely someone who thought it took 4 to 6 weeks. And when I actually started my cycle with injections and exams, I think it was under 2 weeks. You know, the mental preparation and some of the pre-testing happened a little bit before that. So before we get into some more details, there is a pre-testing phase, correct?
Yes, definitely.
And that's to determine if egg freezing is a possibility or a good choice for someone. And can you explain sort of what you as a physician are looking for in those situations?
Yeah, sure. I think that's really important. You know, anytime somebody's thinking about it, I oftentimes will encourage people to consider coming in for a consultation. It's what I call a reproductive checkup visit. It could be for somebody that's thinking about egg freezing. It could be for somebody that thinks that they want to have kids in a couple years, but they're kind of stressed about the process and want to make sure that they're understanding everything. So whatever the case may be, in my mind, that's an hour-long consultation to sit there and do all that education I was talking about, talk through all of the options at that point, and then think about, you know, what makes this person, you know, in a good position to consider egg freezing or not. And so some of that is testing, as just as you said, you know, we do a couple things. So first in the visit, what I often explain essentially is that as women, we're born with all of the eggs we're going to have. And one really fascinating and a little bit sad factoid is that actually we peak at the number of eggs we're going to have when we're about 20 weeks at gestation. So before we're even born, halfway through the pregnancy where we were inside of our mother's uterus, our eggs are already starting to decline. And so, you know, that rate picks up as we get into our mid-30s. And so one of the things that we're looking at essentially is by vaginal ultrasound, how many of these little follicles, which are the fluid-filled sac that eggs grow inside of, we might see at any given cycle. And so, you know, I think that's the important thing to understand is that we are born with all of these eggs, but basically in waves, they're kind of growing a little bit inside of that follicle. And then maybe if somebody's actually ovulating, one of them might have the chance at any given month to actually be ovulated and turn into a pregnancy. But if we're already pregnant, if we're on birth control or whatever the case may be, basically there's just these waves of follicles that grow a little bit and then die off. And so when we look with an ultrasound, we can see, okay, at any given month, this is what we call the antral follicle count, meaning this is the pool that is potentially available for egg freezing that month. And so, you know, when I see somebody for their initial visit, I will say, okay, well, it looks like between the two sides, maybe we've got 12 to 15. And so, you know, that would be give you an idea of how many eggs we might actually be able to get. On top of that, we do some blood work as well. The most important is probably the AMH or anti-Müllerian hormone. That's a hormone that's made by all of those resting follicles. So again, it's sort of the higher it is, the more there are, and it gives me from the best prognostic standpoint available, you know, how somebody's going to respond to medication.
If I come into your office and I have a really low AMH level and you do the vaginal ultrasound and you only see two follicles or two eggs, would you say that maybe I would have a lot less luck with egg freezing?
Yeah, so, you know, it kind of ends up being a little bit of a catch-22 at that point. So, you know, I think the other factors to think about are age and also obviously, just as you said, what the results show. And so if somebody, you know, is only going to have two or three follicles, then I would say, you know, it's true that we may only get one or God forbid, we don't even get any eggs, you know, through the entire cycle. But by the same token, you know, if somebody's trying to get pregnant in the future, you know, even having one to two eggs frozen may make them feel like, okay, at least I have a shot, you know, as opposed to not doing anything at all. And so, you know, that really comes back to age. So, you know, if somebody is 30 and let's say we can get only, you know, maybe only get two or three eggs, chances are that those eggs are chromosomally healthy. The chance of that kind of goes down as we get older. And so that's much more meaningful than, let's say, she came back at age 38 and now she wants to get pregnant. And if we did IVF, you know, starting, we'll talk about some of these finer points. I think we'll get into that a little bit later. But if somebody's doing fresh IVF at 38, let's say, and they still only get two eggs, the chances of them being healthy will be much lower at that age. And so sometimes, you know, even if it doesn't look like a very reassuring picture, we may decide that it makes sense to move forward anyways. And I will say that, you know, sometimes people come in and maybe they're really young, let's say they're in their 20s, but they're just curious and things look very reassuring. They might decide, we might decide together that, you know, this is an option. Can definitely choose to do it, but maybe, you know, we see how life unfolds. And if a couple years go by and maybe it still seems like pregnancy is far away, then maybe you want to do it at that time. And so, you know, it is an investment and you have to decide when is the right time to make it. But I definitely tell people that I don't tell every single person that comes to talk to me about it that 100% they should do it. And, you know, I don't think that would be the right answer to give to everybody. So.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's definitely a very personal choice. I know for me, I went to my first egg freezing appointment when I was around 31 and I just wasn't ready for it at the time, and then finally ended up going back and actually going through the process around 33. It is definitely something where you have to consider all these factors, especially how you think your life is going to unfold. Moving on a little bit from that, so let's say a patient is a good candidate for having their eggs frozen. I remember specifically having to go to a frequent amount of appointments. So one thing that I personally considered was geography and timing of when their lab was able to do my blood draws. So what should a patient consider when they're choosing a doctor for this process?
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, because a lot of times that ends up being a determining factor for people, just like you said. I mean, we'll talk about, I guess, what's required, and it is, you know, a significant time investment, as you said, for a couple weeks of time, but it is intense during that time. And so a lot of times geography ends up being a big factor. But I think that in the end, you know, as much as it can be inconvenient at times, I think picking the right physician and also most importantly, the right clinic is probably the most important thing. And there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, one, I think that everything that, you know, I do as a REI specialist, but especially egg freezing in some ways, is really emotionally charged. You know, a lot of times people are coming in and they feel, you know, why haven't I found this perfect relationship? Or, you know, I'm not ready to be a mom yet. Should there be any guilt associated with that? And no, there shouldn't be any guilt associated with that. But unfortunately, a lot of people feel very self-conscious about it. And so I think being able to have a physician that you feel, you know, some emotional connection with, that you feel comfortable talking to, I think that's really important. But the flip side of that from, you know, that's kind of the art of medicine, but from the science of medicine perspective, you know, a lot of the chances of success relate to the IVF laboratory. And believe it or not, those success rates vary pretty widely when you go from clinic to clinic. And so the good news is that that data is actually publicly available. So the CDC and SART, the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technologies, collect that data and they publish it. And it's actually publicly available online. If you just Google CDC SART, you'll find it. It's important to consider, you know, usually what I tell people is think about a couple clinics that are in your geographical area and look at their success rates and see, okay, out of these couple ones that seem promising, how do the numbers stack up? And those reports are kind of confusing. There's a lot of information in it, but it can start to give you a picture because when you compare all these numbers from place to place, you'll find that there's probably one or two where, you know, the numbers are just across the board much better. And those are the places that you want to go to, particularly for fertility preservation, because the last thing you want is to freeze 10 eggs and then you go back, you know, many years later thinking that you have a good shot, but because they didn't have, you know, great success rates, you know, now you don't end up with what you could have had if you had gone to a place that had more experience and higher rates. So I think that that's a particularly important piece as well that many of us kind of forget, you know, that you're just talking to your doctor and you may love them, but you really want to also do some investigation into the laboratory itself.
I definitely have to agree with that as well. The initial reason that brought me there was the positive things that I had heard about the lab where I froze my eggs. So actually, when I froze my eggs, I had been on birth control for many, many, many years, and they told me I had to go through a washout period. So can you talk a little bit about what that means for birth control?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, basically birth control, typical combined oral contraceptive pills that, you know, are the most common form of birth control, basically they have a little bit of estrogen and a little bit of progesterone in them. And those are the two hormones that the ovaries typically make during the course of the menstrual cycle. And so basically, when we're taking birth control pills, our body is interpreting that as, oh, look, there's already estrogen and progesterone on board. So we don't have to have the ovaries, you know, doing that. We don't have to stimulate the ovaries to get more estrogen and progesterone production. So typically what that ends up meaning is that we're not actually ovulating. And as I mentioned before, you know, those follicles are still, we're kind of still using them up in a way, but we're not necessarily actually releasing an egg that has the potential to be fertilized. So that being said, after many years of being on birth control, we're sort of basically putting ourselves in this suppressive state, which, you know, there's really not long-term consequences to that or permanent consequences to that. But when we come in for that initial visit, I just saw somebody today in that situation. If they've been on birth control for a long time, we do the ultrasound, the ovaries can look very small and we may not see a lot of follicles. And similarly, if I happened to send off that AMH test, it may come back falsely low. And so, you know, that's one of those situations I always prepare somebody for before we do anything, because I don't want that to be unnecessarily alarming. In most cases, if you come off for, you know, about a month or so, 4 to 6 weeks, it depends on the situation, you know, we'll see the ovaries pretty quickly perk up. And so that'll be more reflective of what somebody's true, you know, capacity is for how many eggs we might get in one cycle. But it's definitely true that long-term birth control can have that suppressive effect, and it's something to talk to your specialist about if you're in that situation, for sure.
And just for the clarity of our listeners here, ovulation basically means the egg is being released from the ovary and going into the fallopian tube and down to the uterus where it can be fertilized by sperm. Birth control actually stops that process of being released from the ovary, but the follicle still dies, correct, Rashmi? Or
yeah, that's pretty much correct. So, you know, I was sort of saying that each month or at any given time, there's this cohort of follicles that sort of starts to grow a little bit. They sort of, I always think of it as they're kind of entering the race. They kind of get there to the start line and they say, hey, we're available this month. And if somebody actually ovulates, then one of those, usually one, would be the one to win the race and become the biggest of all of them. And actually, as you said, release itself and the egg is released. And then hopefully if the fallopian tube is open and doing its job, then yep, it can pick it up and maybe it meets a sperm along the way, et cetera, et cetera. But if we're on birth control, basically those follicles are there. They get to the starting line and then it's almost like the race is called off. There's basically nobody that's going to actually start and they just kind of all die off.
I love that. I love that analogy. Yeah. Hey, I'm available for a sperm.
Anyone free? Yeah. No, hey, I try to keep it like kind of lighthearted, especially like I said, you know, this is an emotional thing for most of us as women to talk about. I think that, you know, just kind of having simple analogies that we can all imagine and sort of get a little bit of a laugh out of is really helpful in breaking the tension.
Yeah, no, I think with time, it's going to get more and more widespread with knowledge. And sort of one of the goals of this podcast is to make women more aware of, you know, the details surrounding these topics that are a little controversial and emotionally charged, as you mentioned. So,
yeah.
Okay. So let's say my doctor and me decide that this is an appropriate decision. What's the first day of the process like after we've done all the testing and I've washed out the birth control, the first day that I go in to start the actual process of egg freezing?
So usually that first day is going to be a combination of blood work and vaginal ultrasound again. And basically that is just confirming that there's no cysts on the ovaries, that basically the ovaries are at a baseline. That's generally the best time to start when all those follicles are small. They're not yet making estrogen. And so basically we do that evaluation, make sure everything looks like it should. And then that same afternoon, you usually get a phone call and it says, okay, great. Everything looks fantastic. You're going to start your medication, you know, based on the calendar that you have. And so that could either be that same day or depending on how that practice works, it could be a day or two later, but you know, they'll give you your instructions and then you kind of go from there. So that first day is just again, confirming that, okay, you know, we thought everything is ready to go. We're going to do one more last check. We'll look again at the follicle number. That's going to be the actual follicle count for that cycle. And then we take it from there.
And so my appointments were sometimes every other day and sometimes every day. What determines how often you have to go in once you start the process?
It's usually every couple of days to start off with, and then it becomes a little bit closer together as you get towards the end. And basically, you know, the way I typically describe it is that most of the time you're going to come in and we're going to do blood work and ultrasound again. And essentially what we're looking for is out of that cohort of follicles, how many are growing, how big are they, and then how much estrogen are they making? And those are the things that help us determine how is the cycle going? Do we need to change anything about your medications? When do we need to see you back? And then ultimately at the end, are we ready to go ahead and schedule the egg retrieval? And so, you know, as we get closer towards the end, that's where sometimes we might say, okay, we think you're going to be ready tomorrow. And then somebody comes back and we're like, oh, sorry, we need one more day. And we're just really trying to optimize, you know, your outcomes. And so sometimes it ends up being, you know, a couple of days in a row that we really need to see you towards the end.
And the egg retrieval should happen on the day that the follicles are the biggest?
So basically what we want, we look at the size, you know, usually every practice will have their own criteria, but usually once the biggest follicles are about 18 millimeters or more, there's at least a few that are in that range. And then we look at the entire cohort of follicles, you know, how big are most of them? Then we sort of determine, okay, it seems like this is the right time. And usually that's after about 8 to 10 days of medication, of the injectable medication. So it can vary a little bit, but that's the usual time frame. So about a week and a half. And then at that point, we give that night, we give a medication that we call the trigger medication. And you might remember that. And, you know, basically all that is it's another medication, but it kind of finalizes the maturation of the eggs and gets them ready to be released. And then from there, typically it's about 36 hours later that we do the actual egg retrieval procedure. So usually what happens is you get a call that day and it'll say, okay, your trigger is going to be at 8 p.m. tonight. And that timing is very important because it's correlated with the timing that the egg retrieval is planned for 2 mornings later. So that's kind of how that looks the last couple of days.
Yeah, I definitely remember that because my trigger medication had to be delivered at 2 a.m. So I waiting up for that. But no, it was great. I mean, I had a successful cycle. So just to give our listeners sort of summary, every morning is usually lab work and an ultrasound. And then you usually get a call in the afternoon to guide you on what dose of medication you're supposed to inject yourself with, because as Rashmi mentioned, it's a very fine process that needs to be fine-tuned. Is that accurate, Rashmi?
Mm-hmm. That is correct. Yep. Essentially, we're just monitoring to make sure the response is, you know, exactly where we want it. We don't want you to go too high. You know, if somebody has really great, what we call ovarian reserve, meaning that there's a whole bunch of follicles there, then, you know, we don't want all of a sudden, you know, to grow too many follicles. Actually, that can become unsafe if we're just giving somebody, you know, really high doses of medication and maybe they're super young or they have a lot of follicles. So we're just kind of, as you said, fine tuning things along the way to make sure that that response we're getting is right in the middle, you know, of being where we want it to be.
And that's great that you mentioned that, because what I didn't know when I was going through the cycle of egg freezing is that I couldn't work out. And that actually really changed my lifestyle because that's something I used to do every day. So can you talk about some of what the patient responsibility is at home when they're going through this?
Sure. So that's super important. And, you know, basically what that part is about exercise is that our ovaries kind of hang inside of our pelvis by two ligaments. And so what that means is they can kind of move around a little bit. As they grow multiple follicles, they become much bigger and kind of heavier than they typically are. And so the concern about exercise is just that if, you know, let's say somebody's doing jump squats or yoga inversions or something kind of what I would call high impact, the concern is that as those ovaries kind of bounce up and down, could they basically spin over and cut off their own blood supply? And that's what we call an ovarian torsion. And that can become very serious. It could become a surgical emergency. You know, we definitely don't want that. So, you know, typically what I tell people is that low to moderate impact exercise is okay. You know, definitely, like I said, nothing that involves jumping, no inversions, nothing like that. But, you know, usually depending on what somebody does, we can figure out a way that's safe that allows them the ability to do something to move, you know, because again, for many people, that's just part of their healthy lifestyle. It's part of their stress management. And, you know, again, although it's only, you know, a couple weeks, still, I don't want to disrupt somebody's life more than I have to. So definitely something really important to talk to your physician about is what they feel comfortable with. And that's probably a big part of their responsibility, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I'll be honest, I was so paranoid about ovarian torsion because, you know, it's ironic, right? You're sitting here trying to preserve your fertility. And if you have ovarian torsion, I mean, it could really affect your fertility. Yes. Because you could lose an ovary. I actually, in the beginning of my cycle, I stopped exercising, but towards the later half, like maybe day 6 to day 11 or so, I felt sort of heavy in those areas, like on the sides. Is that something common to feel that way?
Yeah. I mean, that's actually the most common side effect that I tell people is you're going to feel, you know, I almost say it's going to be like you ate a really huge salty meal, but except for you feel like that for a couple days. You know, basically what it is a couple things. One, the ovaries, again, are growing much larger than they typically are. And so you're going to kind of feel that pressure as they're pushing on other, you know, your intestines, your bladder, your bowels, you know, just all of the other stuff that's in that area. So that's one part of it. And then the other part is that as your estrogen level goes up, we actually retain a little bit of fluid. So again, it's that whole like salty feeling of eating some really horrible salty meal where you're just retaining a lot of fluid. And so it can just feel kind of like bloating, fullness. People describe it differently, but you know, those would be the main side effects that I would expect if, you know, we're getting more than just a few follicles for sure.
Yeah, that's sort of exactly how I felt. Can you talk about any other lifestyle changes that you should anticipate? I mean, can you drink alcohol? Can you not?
Two other things that I tell most people. So one, to answer your question about alcohol, there is some data that suggests that more than, you know, moderate alcohol intake can reduce the ovarian responsiveness during stimulation. So I always tell people, you know, if you can, you know, if you have to have a glass of wine here or there, let's say you go to a work function or something, you know, that's fine. That's most likely not going to affect anything. But I try to keep it to that as a maximum. And, you know, if there is a time where you can just abstain for that entire 2-week window, that's probably the safest thing. And then the other thing I will tell people is that, you know, it's important to realize for some of my patients considering egg freezing, they may actually be in a heterosexual relationship where they're sexually active. And so, first of all, obviously the goal of egg freezing is to get all of your eggs into the laboratory. But at the time of procedure, it's always possible that one of the eggs could float off. So definitely don't want to have unprotected intercourse towards the end of the cycle, because theoretically, I guess you could get pregnant. So that would not be the goal if it's not what you want at that time. So don't do that. And then the other thing, kind of as you were alluding to before about just how you feel, a lot of times it's just uncomfortable to have intercourse at that time. So, you know, that's another thing I'll mention to my patients that are actually in a relationship at that time, that, you know, that's another thing you're going to have to keep in mind, that, you know, probably going to not want to have intercourse during this window. And definitely if you do, then use protection.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That'd be very ironic to say the least. But so what, can you talk a little bit about the actual day of the procedure?
Yeah, sure. So main thing to know is that you're going to need somebody to come with you and take you home, because after getting the medication, so it's IV sedation. So it's not full-on general anesthesia where you're having a breathing tube and everything. In this case, you are breathing on your own. There will be an anesthesiologist to monitor all of your vital signs. You should meet them, you know, usually that morning. And then basically you get medication through the IV that will totally knock you out for the actual procedure. So typically you'll walk into the room, you'll meet the rest of the staff in the room, and then you'll either get the IV placed or already have it in place and then start to get the medication. It's actually a pretty quick procedure. It takes maybe about 10 minutes. And then from there, you'll wake up in the recovery room. And so, you know, everybody's a little bit different. And so some people wake up pretty quickly. Some people need a couple of hours to sort of be fully awake. But essentially, we want to make sure that you're able to walk around, that you're feeling okay, your pain is controlled, you're not feeling super nauseous, you're able to eat or keep some food down. And then we let you go home. But again, you're going to be a little sleepy. So we want somebody there to help you get home. Definitely no driving, but even in, you know, New York or other cities that have public transportation, definitely need somebody to sign you out and vouch for you getting home in one piece. So that's probably the most important thing to know. Typically, I tell people to try to take it easy that day. You know, I've had patients that really, really, really want to go back to work that day. If it's completely unavoidable, you know, and depending on what kind of job you have, it may be possible, but I really try to encourage people to focus on themselves that day if they can, because it's hard to know how you're going to react to the anesthesia and everything else. And, you know, you just don't want to add more stress onto a process that's already a little bit stressful.
Yeah, no, totally. I had one of my really good girlfriends come pick me up and we went out to lunch. It was actually great. And one thing,
that's awesome.
One thing I do want to sort of mention is the drug that I got through the IV to make me sleepy was propofol. Is that pretty much the one that is used, or are there different choices?
Yeah, that is the most common one. It's usually a mix of a couple things, but that's the main one. And so, you know, sometimes that gets a bad rep if, you know, you've heard any of the headlines with.
Oh, so I just want to jump in and comment on that, because I, during cataract surgery, we use propofol for my patients, and I now have such a greater appreciation for all my cataract surgery patients who went through having propofol during cataract surgery, because, you know, we always tell them it's going to burn. And having experienced it, I was like, oh my God, that really, really burns. Like I had no idea how much it burns. And so I have a newfound respect for all my patients when I'm doing cataract surgery, when they're getting the propofol. I'm like, you know, it does burn. So
yeah, be prepared. Having a great anesthesiologist always helps. And, you know, we're lucky we have a great team to work with, but you're right. There are some things that, you know, people just will say at that moment, you're like, okay, you know, that's okay. Or people alluded to, you know, Michael Jackson and all kinds of other things. But anyways, propofol is a very safe medication. This anesthesia is generally pretty minimal, honestly. And so although I will say the anesthesia part contributes to most of the side effects on the day of, it's really quite safe. And so, you know, relatively low risk. I will say that it did come up, actually. You might have read some stuff about the coverage on This Is Us, and there was a whole storyline about, you know, body mass index and weight and whether it's safe to undergo the anesthesia for IVF. And so, you know, that is another consideration we always think about, you know, is what is somebody else's, you know, what are all of the health concerns that somebody has, and are they going to be able to maintain their breathing in a safe airway during sedation? So, you know, there are other factors we think about, but obviously that's all stuff we plan well ahead of time.
Yeah, no, totally. And I think we had sort of talked about this before, but can you also tell me, are there any chronic conditions? So I know that for egg freezing, it's, you know, for the most part intended for women that want to preserve their fertility. But, you know, what if there's a young couple and they've been married for a couple years and they're just not ready to have kids, but she has some sort of chronic condition that may impact her fertility? Are there any chronic conditions that exist egg freezing could help preserve fertility in?
Yeah, that is a really great question. And I think it's really important. And I do see a reasonable number of people coming in for that exact same situation where, you know, maybe they are in their early 30s and they got married and, you know, could be relatively young, I guess, depending on what part of the country you're in. You know, maybe they want to wait for 4 or 5 years, but they might want to have multiple kids. And so they're kind of realizing that, you know, by the time they start, it might become difficult. And so, you know, definitely we can do egg freezing in that situation, or we can actually go ahead and fertilize the eggs and freeze them as embryos. So, you know, those are the two options we have at that point. But, you know, I think it's another thing, like you said, worth considering for specific situations. So there's definitely some evidence, you know, and this is not 100% proven, but there is some evidence that, you know, chronic conditions that are particularly autoimmune conditions could put somebody at risk for having ovarian reserve that's lower than the age-based average. And so there have been reports of things like people that have inflammatory bowel disease or autoimmune thyroid disease, that perhaps, you know, is there a risk that their ovarian reserve is going to be lower because of that? So, you know, sometimes I get patients that come in to talk about that and just want to kind of know where they are. And so same thing as I was saying before, sometimes couples come in and they want this information and, you know, they get checked out and they're like, okay, we actually feel confident and we're not going to do anything right now. So that's one. But I think probably the most important one to think about is actually endometriosis, which is basically a condition where the type of cells that typically line the inside of the uterus, the part that sheds when we have our period, those kinds of cells start to grow elsewhere in the body. And so typically that presents with, you know, painful periods is kind of the most common presentation. But one of the things that that can do is that endometriosis can actually grow inside of the ovaries, and it can create these cysts that eat into the normal ovarian tissue. And so there is an association with diminished ovarian reserve in women that have endometriosis as well. And so, you know, that's another thing. It might make sense to freeze eggs. I have also seen a couple patients that, you know, incidentally either had endometriosis or maybe they had a history of pelvic inflammatory disease of some kind earlier in life and then found out or were worried that maybe their tubes were blocked and that they were going to need IVF, you know, eventually anyways to get pregnant. And so then they came in to just go ahead and freeze eggs because they realized they were going to have to do this to get pregnant in the future. You know, that's kind of another situation. So again, you know, I typically tell people, if you have any concern, just come talk it out with us, because there can be a variety of situations we may not have thought of that makes sense to think about fertility preservation.
Another question I wanted to ask you is, what would you say the reasons are that people do more than one egg freezing cycle? So when I did mine, I got 10 eggs and I thought about doing another, ended up meeting my husband, so I didn't. But is there some number of eggs where a patient should strongly consider a second cycle?
It ends up being a very individual decision. I mean, I think in an ideal situation, we like to get into the double digits in terms of numbers. But again, you know, if I had somebody said, okay, well, you said I got 10 eggs, you know, but you were in your early 30s. If somebody got, you know, 10 eggs and they were 42, you know, which it's a question mark of, you know, how old is too old to think about egg freezing. But let's just say, you know, in your 40s, again, you know, the chances of those same number of eggs being able to turn into a healthy embryo is going to be a lot lower. And so, you know, it becomes a very individual decision. What is the number that makes you feel comfortable? And then also, you know, what is the goal? You know, some people come in and they really want to be able to have multiple children. And so depending on, you know, what age they might actually start trying to get pregnant and, you know, what might be biologically plausible at that time, that also helps us guide, you know, what's the goal number. And, you know, again, you mentioned before that some women are going to get, you know, maybe just two or three eggs. So getting to, you know, the teens might be, you know, a really costly process and require multiple cycles. And maybe that's not possible. So again, you know, I think part of the initial consult is to get a realistic idea of what's possible for that person. And then what's the goal for that person? And that number, there's not a magic number. People always ask, like, what's your goal? And it's not the same for every woman. Definitely not.
So I'm glad you brought that up about costs, because when I was freezing my eggs, I did not know that my insurance would cover any part of it. Has been your experience with your patients and their, you know, insurances?
Yeah, so that's always an interesting question. And it's amazing to me that for every insurance company, there are so many different nitty-gritty details to the different policies that they offer. And a lot of it is employer dependent. And then for, you know, any given employer, oftentimes they have multiple tiers that they might offer their employees. And sometimes the higher tier plans have more in the way of fertility benefits. Or more and more, there are actually third-party companies that are coming in to other employers and saying, hey, we can manage your fertility benefits for you, outsourced to us. And so it's really amazing that the opportunities and the options are growing. And so what is, again, part of the initial consultation is that opportunity to meet with finance and have your specific policy queried so that you can get a realistic answer. Because a lot of times people will call on their own to their insurance. And it's amazing that, you know, sometimes they just get the wrong answers. And it's just a matter of being able to ask the very specific questions that our finance team can ask to get you the most accurate information. So more and more places are covering it. And as you said, sometimes maybe only part of it is covered, but that's better than nothing. And so that's super important. And I think one additional thing I should definitely mention is that another situation that comes up with egg freezing is for women that maybe have just gotten a diagnosis of cancer. You know, we do a lot of fertility preservation in that situation as well, particularly for women that maybe just get a diagnosis of breast cancer or lymphoma is another one I've seen a couple times. And so there are some of these cancers that affect young women who have not, you know, kind of finished building their family yet. And so in that situation, believe it or not, we can oftentimes start stimulation right away, regardless of where somebody is in their cycle. And there are better financing options. We typically offer a discount, and there are other programs out there that will help direct people to get medications and get discounts so we can make it plausible so people can preserve the ability to have kids, you know, when they're ready.
Oh, that's great. I actually had no idea that that was something that was possible. I just assumed that because they already had, you know, such a tough diagnosis, that egg freezing would not be an option at all.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's one of the things. There's a lot of studies on this topic that is just a neglected topic of fertility within the oncology world. But, you know, more and more studies keep coming out, and it's definitely standard of care within the oncology world now to be at least bringing this topic up. I will say that, you know, oftentimes, just like you said, it's a heavy diagnosis. And so sometimes people, you know, can't do this on top of everything else, or maybe they decide it's not worth even the 2 weeks of delaying, you know, maybe starting chemotherapy or something to think about doing this. But, you know, a lot of times people will still come in for the consult and get some of the information, and we can talk about their specific plan and whether, you know, what we understand about how that will impact their fertility, and then we take it from there. But, you know, sometimes, you know, we get people that really, really, you know, this is important, and they want to kind of try to knock this out really quickly and then move on to fighting their cancer. In that situation, we do everything we can to make it possible.
And does egg freezing, like the actual process of retrieving the egg, like the surgical part of it, does that pose a risk to bearing children naturally in the future?
No, it doesn't. So that's another really reassuring point, which is that basically the only follicles we can access at any given time are the ones that we're going to do something that month, right? So the ones that we're either going to ovulate or die off or whatever they were going to do. But those are the only ones we have access to. And so, you know, doing an egg retrieval or multiple egg retrievals doesn't decrease your own natural fertility. And we kind of have some evidence to that point when we look at women that have donated their eggs. So when we look at egg donors, you know, just for, you know, kind of, I guess, safety, our professional society, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, has said that, you know, we should limit the number of donation cycles we do to 5. But, you know, there's not really any concrete proof that, barring any unusual complication or something like that, that there should be any impact on somebody's future fertility. So that's kind of, you know, nice. Just because somebody freezes eggs, it doesn't necessitate them to have to do IVF in the future.
Okay, awesome. And, you know, we're going to get wrapped up here. And I just wanted to, you know, ask you if you had any final points you wanted to make our listeners aware of. And I also just wanted to mention something. When you're buying medications, I think it's important, because the medications are so expensive, to maybe buy them in waves, because I made the mistake of buying a ton of medication up front, which I then could not, you know, you can't return it. You know, I paid it forward and gave it to another friend who was undergoing a cycle a few months later. But I think that's something that I wish I had sort of known ahead of time. Anything else you sort of want to add or comment on?
I think we've covered pretty much everything. I just, you know, I think this is really fantastic. I think it's really great when people talk openly about their experiences and get this information out there. You know, I think really egg freezing is a really fascinating thing, and it is sort of that first part of the IVF cycle. So I think that, you know, for many women that have certain diagnoses or just looking at the timeline of things, it just makes a lot of sense to get this done at potentially an earlier age than, you know, when they might need to do IVF in the future. So I think it's a really great topic, and thank you so much for chatting with me about it.
Yes, I'm so happy that we were able to chat today, and I hope we add a lot of value to our listeners. And before we wrap up, I do want our listeners to know that if they are seriously considering egg freezing and they want the statistics on average rates of success and failures, the Thumb Health Podcast does have a publication that is backed by evidence-based medicine, and you can head to the website to get a copy of it. There's really a ton of information on there. It goes into a lot of detail on several female health topics, not just egg freezing. And finally, Rashmi, thank you so much for being on the podcast, talking about egg freezing. So informative. We're definitely going to have you back for many, many future episodes. There's so much more to discuss. Awesome. Thank you so much for taking time out to talk to us today.
Definitely. I'll talk to you soon.
We always like to include a quick but important disclaimer that the views expressed on this podcast are the individual views of doctors and do not represent any institution or organization that the doctors are affiliated with. What is most important about our podcast is that everything you hear is backed by science and evidence-based medicine.